people are so hungry to really be understood, and the supply of that high quality understanding is so low. The challenge I think that's primary now is a growing inability to understand each other. I can't think of really many circumstances, maybe I can't think of any, in which the process that is essentialism is not the right process.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's Lightwolf podcast. I'm Stefan, a leadership catalyst and your podcast host. And today I have a huge pleasure, to introduce one of the most highly accomplished business authors on this planet. It's my pleasure to introduce Greg McKeon. Greg, welcome to the Lightwolf podcast.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Greg McKeon and his wife, Anna, are proud parents of four children. Greg is the author of two New York Times bestsellers, Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less. Here is the German version. And Effortless, Make It Easier to Do What Matters Most, which together have sold 3 million copies and have been published in 40 different languages. That alone gives us already a glimpse of the impact, Greg, that you are having. Greg, you also recently released the Essentialism Planner, a 90-day guide to accomplishing more by doing less. Greg holds a master's degree from Stanford University and conducts doctoral research at the University of Cambridge. Greg, you spoke to hundreds of organizations, including companies like Apple, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Nike, X, and even the Navy SEALs. And that's already, I think, a great intro. Let's get into some of the content. Let's start with Essentialism, Greg. Since its publication in 2014, Essentialism has become part of a wider culture. In Japan, there are series of novels, graphic novels, around Essentialism. And in Brazil, Essentialism even outsold Harry Potter. And having read it, I understand completely. I understand why. But question to you, my first question. When you published Essentialism 11 years ago, Greg, did you ever expect such an extraordinary success?
No, it's been such a beautiful ride, really, and humbling in so many ways. I'm not convinced that I've written great books, but I think that they have spoken to great needs and pain points in the world, and so I think that that's what it reveals. It reveals something about the zeitgeist, the feeling and culture and circumstance of the world. And just to be part of helping a conversation that in some ways has become a movement is a special and meaningful thing for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you remember the moment when the core thought leading to Essentialism went through your mind?
I mean, there's so many answers to that question because ideas flow through us in, you know, multi-narrative form. I mean, the origin story that is most associated with the answer to your question was when I received an email from my manager at the time saying, look, Friday between 1 and 2 p.m. would be a very bad time for your wife to have a baby because I need you to be at this client meeting. And I'm sure they were joking. But as the early hours of Friday morning, our daughter was born and was in the hospital with my wife, Anna, and our old baby. Instead of being focused, I had my phone on, my laptop open. I'm trying to navigate everything. And then to my shame, I go to the meeting. And even afterwards, I remember my manager saying, well, look, the client will respect you for the choice you just made. And the look on their faces didn't really evince that sort of respect. But even if they had, it's clear that I made a fool's bargain. I learned the simplest of lessons from this, which is if you don't prioritize your life, someone else will. And so this, in a sense, is the origin moment, because what I have learned over time is that I'm not alone, even if that particular story is unique to me, of many other stories that people feel, because so many people feel busy, but not necessarily productive, stretched too thin at work or at home, feeling that their day is hijacked by other people's agenda for them. And I would just say, maybe parenthetically, I think it's in the more than 10 years since Essentialism was published, I think the problem has continued. I would say that the challenge is greater. In fact, I think the challenge has shifted significantly, but we could get into that as we go forward.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, thank you also very much for sharing this moment when your wife Anna gave birth. Wow. And I can see how this touched you and how this is a moment that influenced your thinking on it. Thank you very much for sharing this. Yeah. Mm. One way I could introduce myself literally is that probably I am one of your strongest salesmen on the planet. Here is how your book Essentialism and how you entered my life. Mm. It's been just three years ago, I think. And greetings go out here to Barry DeQuan. Barry DeQuan is director of one of the very best international schools in the world, the ISDL in central Switzerland, in Zug.
And yes, he said, I know it.
Have you heard of ISDL?
Yes.
It's a strong school. I had both my kids there, Greg.
Congratulations.
And, you know, no school, nothing, I think, is perfect. And I kissed goodbye to the concept of perfectionism when I was 17. Because in my thinking, perfection is neither possible, because we're human, and it's not desirable either, because I want things to continue improving. So nothing's perfect. Mm-hmm. But what I love about this school is that it does not only do well in terms of academic education. In my perception, having had two young men there, it also helps personalities shape and unfold. So the director, Barry, was the one bringing you into my life. And he said, Stefan, have you heard of Essentialism? I said, Barry, no, not yet. You have to hear this quote. Here is Greg McKeon talking to you, Stefan. Quote, "You cannot overestimate the unimportance of almost anything." Unquote. Greg, I burst into immediate laughter because I felt detected. I felt as if you knew me already. This is the first time we meet. A big, great quote that really struck me. Now, it sounded already that your journey to the topics you publish about, well, yes, I think you really strike a chord by entering the center of what touches people. I'd like to understand the way how you got to like reading and writing, because that's a core of what you do. Do you remember the first time you were fascinated by a book?
I have been really fascinated with ideas and principles since I was very young. Let's say the church that I was raised in had an unusual approach to teaching, in that there's no paid clergy of any kind, and so all of the teaching is done by members of the parish, let's say, including children. And so, you know, where, you know, there's a scriptural idea about this, that a little child will lead you by the hand. That idea that children can be leaders and children can be teachers is real, and it's honored, and in more than I have seen in any other organization. And so from a very young age, I was in situations to share, to teach, to listen, to understand. So principles, quotes, I remember, you know, very young, certainly by the time I was, let's say, 10, having a quote book that I would fill you know, the best ideas that I came across, the ones I would like to memorize or come back to, gathering those together and reviewing them very often so that those ideas really became a part of the thinking, you know, the operating system of my life young, and younger than I really fully appreciated how helpful that was to do that. You know, I mean, of course, at the time I saw it, well, why not, you know, put that in there, but unaware of how powerful operating systems really are in our lives and how often they are written, you know, the code is written without our conscious awareness. And so to be doing this from a very young age, I mean, I look back and I'm just very grateful for the various influences that encouraged me, you know, to think like that. I did read books from a young age, and the books that I read tended to be nonfiction books. So I've read a great deal more fiction in the last 5 years of my life than I did in, let's say, the first 20 years of my life. So, you know, there's been a shift in that regard. I mean, you're trying to identify like the first, you know, the first book that kind of really sparked something in me. And I'm not sure I can identify that. I mean, Jonathan Livingston Seagull was a book that was read to me many times. It's, you know, sort of depending on who you talk to, that's like either a 1970s, you know, it is a 1970s book, but a kind of new age, a certain kind of vibe to that book. But for me, it was meaningful. And the metaphor in it is about a person who becomes an outcast and learns to seek purpose in their life rather than to go along with the flock, to go along with the crowd. And they pay a great price for that, but they also gain enormous benefits. And primary among them is to spend a life learning. And that seems like a good way to, you know, wrap this answer to you, because I think the difference between a person who reads only because it's in the exams, it's in their high school, it's in their university program, versus a person who becomes a lifelong learner and becomes a serious student of books, of classics, is enormously different. And my, you know, I in some ways, and with no false modesty, think of myself as a kind of a late bloomer. In lots of ways, I find like there's been great benefits that have come just from an ongoing interest in learning and reading, and I'm hungrier now to learn this like this moment than I have ever been in my life, and so you know it goes on.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I think lifelong learning is a great path to fulfilled lives, to happiness, and also to success in business. And you just said something about children. You have four kids yourself. I'm right. A father of two myself.
Congratulations.
Same to you, Greg. I think it's fascinating, and I don't do it enough, to just calmly observe children or let children, like you say, let children take us by the hand and guide us by the hand. Do you remember a moment when you learned something powerful, valuable from a child?
The first thought that comes to my mind as you ask that good, meaningful question is, it's like there's some saying along the lines of, you know, I could as well tell you the number of people who have influenced me for good as I could tell you all of the meals I've eaten in my life. Like, it's just so many, it's impossible. And I feel like that with children. With our four children, I mean, there's so many things that one gets wrong in parenting and you know, myself included. One of the things that has been extremely useful and that I have tried to come back to endlessly, like the airplane that's off track 90% of the time but keeps coming back on track, is to come back to understanding, to create a space between agreeing and disagreeing, to really understand. And that you can do, I mean, of course, quite literally, at first, you know, a parent, usually a mother, is immediately doing that. You know, the moment a child is born, they are having to tune into them. And the first lesson of life is that if we're not heard, we will die. And so there's a very powerful relationship to understanding in our lives. I've done a lot of research now on this, and so it's like our primary lesson, our deepest need, our greatest fear. You know, to be misunderstood, to be judged is awful. You know, it's a lifelong concern. It creates primal panic in us when we're misunderstood. And this starts, it's cradle to grave. So what it means, among other things, is that I have tried to slow down and really listen to my children. I have tried many, hundreds and hundreds of times, come back, not to what I think about this yet, not what I feel about this, not whether they think it's the right thing or the wrong thing that they're doing, to understand. How are you? Come and tell me about you. How are you really? Let me listen to you and to say that to them. I want to understand how you see this, and to start when they're very little, and then to just continue doing that. Because, and this maybe is now a specific answer to your question about one thing I have learned, is that I have learned that very little people, their emotions are as real as mine. You know, their experience is as real as mine. There's a word for this. It's not a well-known word, but the word is sonder, S-O-N-D-E-R. Sonder means to, it's like an awakening that other people have as complex and real emotions and experiences and code words and games they're playing and all of that. Everything that makes our life rich and complex is happening in another person's life. That's sonder. And that's true with a child. And it is so frequent that I see people, you know, parents, very understandably, I think, in lots of instances, stuck in their own heads. And so, you know, in an extreme, if you're stuck in your own head, other people aren't really real to you. They're just kind of characters in your movie. And it's very easy to have our children be that. They're just you know, important characters, but in my movie. And if you can shelve that kind of egocentric way of looking at the world and become aware of their world and enter their world, it is so rich and so beautiful and so important. And their fears so striking, and their joy is so pure. And so, and of course, from that embryo of an idea, you can then develop that same consciousness, awareness, empathy for other people in your life, for the adults, for as a manager, for the people that you manage, for clients too. People are so hungry to really be understood, and the supply of that high quality understanding is so low, it produces an incredible opportunity. If we say, like in the marketplace of relationships, the opportunity is enormous. A person who can meet that need, who can withhold evaluation and really understand, this is a 10x or more value. And indeed, everything that has been successful for me, everything, 25 years of a great marriage, great relationship with our four children, their great relationships with each other, the best-selling books, the keynotes, the business from scratch, all of it It's the same principle. It's this principle. Can you understand and really enter the world of another? Write with the reader's mind in mind. Speak with the audience's mind in mind. Listen with the child's mind in mind. That is something I've learned from listening to children.
Yeah, massive. Thank you so much. There are so many avenues that start from here that cross your and my conviction, Greg. This core central idea of truly understanding, of not just hearing what people say, but truly feeling what people mean with all our senses. And also, in my experience as someone who is a lifelong learner on leadership, I experienced that communication and leadership are like inseparable twins. Yeah. You may know the quote from Paul Watzlawick, who once said, "You cannot not communicate." Right? I like it a lot. And one of, I think, resonating with your thought that you just elaborated on is to take a recipient-oriented attitude in communication. Yeah, so really understanding before wanting to be understood. I think one of the other avenues that crosses our professions is learning, Greg. And I read in my preparation for this interview that next to the books that are like famous already, and they will get much more famous down the road, you also help people access your perspectives and your knowledge via online courses. Do you perceive differences in what people learn? I mean, it's obvious that reading a book probably serves a different reading preference versus engaging in an online academy. But maybe you want to briefly describe the differences between those two avenues to relate with you. What's the difference between learning via reading your books versus via joining your online academy?
Well, I mean, that's a thoughtful question. And I mean, one answer to that question is that people are really, I would say, quite desperate, you could just say they have a desire for, but I think it might be stronger than that, for experiences. And I think that has a lot to do with the rapid digitization of everything. So if you look at how people spend their time over the last 100 years, and you plot that on a simple chart, and you follow it through every year for 100 years, of course the internet doesn't show up at all until let's say about the last maybe 30 years, and then it has been exponential increase. And what has been traded off, because of course we weren't printing any more time, is time with friends and with family. That's sort of the primary thing that you're eliminating. And so there is this. I had on my podcast Brad Smith, who's the president of Microsoft, and one of the things he said that I think is really well put is that for 100 years, all of the technologies we've created that make it easier for people to connect at distance have come at the cost of connecting with people closest to home. And that's itself well worth pondering. But where I think that develops is that we have an close to infinite supply of I'm trying to find the right word, of asynchronous video information, and so it leaves people. There is some upsides to those things. I think it's incredible that we can learn almost anything from almost anyone, and often at very low price, through some of these online avenues. But it also leaves people, because it's kind of a counterfeit for connection. It has upsides, but there's still something that it doesn't give us, that humanness, that right-nowedness. People are hungry for experiences. And so, this is my vision for the Essentialism Academy, is that there's a live class. In fact, there's a series that we're that I've announced, but we haven't actually begun them yet, this this next phase. And it's about, you know, this deep understanding and deep connection and why it's so important, why it's such an opportunity, why I think it's such an urgent problem, perhaps the most essential challenge facing humanity, which sounds like sort of outrageously, what's the word I'm looking for? Exaggerated. I don't think it is. The challenge I think that's primary now is our growing inability to understand each other. In the United States now, the latest data we have is that 1 in 6 people have stopped talking to a family member or loved one because of polarization.
Whoa.
And there's data on that that supports that basic, that basic level in Europe, in most of the developed world. So if it can be 1 in 6, it can be 1 in 3, it can be 1 in 2. And those, I think there's no end to the degree to which we can understand each other. And there's almost no end to the degree to which we can misunderstand each other. So it's, it's a double exponential curve that's at risk. And so the academy up to this point has been like, let's call it version 1.0. There are high quality videos, the masterclass type videos. There are some principles people can get. All of the podcast transcripts, the videos that go with that, the audio, all of that is in the academy. So there's quite a lot in there. But with the launching of now this interpersonal effectiveness, these skills and abilities and mindsets to enable us to understand each other, this I think has to be live. You can of course have recordings of things, and we will, and we'll save those videos, but the live element I think allows people to feel and to connect and to be able to sense that. And I think there's a hunger for it. That's, yeah, I think, the primary difference between this view for the academy and reading a book.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. Completely agree and resonates with me. On that note of digitalization changing our lives in different ways, in profound ways, an experience. And my next question to you. About a year ago, one of my partners and I were working in Northern Italy for a 3 days program with an Italian company. And just before we started, we always are there a day in advance, I asked a 22-year-old young lady, Alessandra, can you imagine that I was born before internet and email on smartphones? And she looked at me and she said, Stefan, yes, I can. Probably life was better then.
That's a great response. That's a great little twist to the story.
Isn't it, from a 22-year-old? And Greg, I was surprised. Just slight kidding. I have a 19-year-old. Had I asked him the same question, he would have said, yeah, daddy, you're just trying to brag again that you met dinosaurs alive, right? Yeah. But she was considered. She was serious. When she said, Stefan, probably life was better then. Yeah. So this is maybe a build on your double exponential curve going in both directions in terms of understanding and how the digital life makes it maybe easier to connect with many more people, even when they are not live there. But on the other hand, we are paying a price. And we are learning. And one of the things I'd like to learn more about, with your permission, Greg, is young Greg. When you were a pupil, and I still remember my life plan at the age of 7, which was a kid's plan, and then life came in between. But maybe you want to share with our audience, with the people on the call today, a little bit about the pupil and the student you were when you were younger?
Well, I wasn't an extraordinary student by any stretch. I would say that one of the things that it is, I mean, we're talking like middle school and high school. One of the things that I struggled with, and I started to also, I went on a mission for 2 years, and then afterwards was went to law school for almost a year. And in all of that, I had the same challenge, which is that I would learn to try to really understand, you know, like a thinker. I wouldn't have never used the phrase at the time, but maybe like a philosopher or something like that, like deep understanding. And it's not rewarded. It's not the thing. It's not like this, not how to get A's. And I got pretty good grades in the end still, even at that time. But everything changed in my ability to perform in structured learning as soon as I understood this is the simplest of ideas, right? Which is that, okay, look, getting A's is a game, and that the game has a, you know, both a scoreboard and also, you know, here's the content that you know, it's like, just do what the teacher tells you to do. You know, because I would go to the library on whatever, and I would try to be pulling out books. I found it also fascinating and interesting, and go deep and try to connect. And it's like, look, you know, no one's giving you any grades for that. And so that's not the same as me losing a love of deep learning. It was just a separation. Okay, this is how you get the A's so that you can get on and get to the top business school, and then you can, you know, continue on in this way. Like, that's one game. And then there's deep learning, which is a different lifelong learning pursuit. So as a student, I think I was, you know, I was in a sense the same as I am now, but I was underprepared for the game I was actually in and how to win at it. You know, beyond that, I would say that I would say that there was always a writer in me, and really the only difference between writers and everybody else is that writers write, and that's it. You know, so anyone can be a writer who is willing to suffer, and I say that in inverted commas, suffer in the same way, which is every day write something. It doesn't have to be good. Nobody said you had to write something good. That's the secret and genius and maybe the unspoken part about being a writer. The whole advantage of it is that it doesn't have to be good, because tomorrow you can rewrite it, and you can rewrite it 50 times. And there are things I have rewritten 50 times. So it doesn't matter. All you have to do is write. Write something rubbish. Write something bad, but do it every day. And that was now another game that I learned. But I think the heart of the writer was always there, but the opportunity came later.
Yeah, awesome. I also love your thought that is so empowering and so encouraging, that you don't have to be good at what you write first time around. You can redo it, right?
So really, nobody writes well the first time. Really. That's really important. I'm saying it to you because you know, you've developed all of these ideas, and I'm sure there'll be more to write in the future, and people listening to this or watching this the same. But it's like, you just start and it's rubbish. And then it becomes less rubbish. And the goal is less wrong, less wrong, less wrong, until eventually you go, that's actually kind of interesting. And then eventually, actually, that's good. Oh, that's a great turn of phrase. And you've got one great phrase, and maybe you've written 10 times and to get one great phrase. But now you have it, one gem. And you just have to be willing to keep doing it until eventually you have a chapter's worth of gems. Books worth of gems. And then you go, yeah, that's something that's worth reading. Then that's one of the great investments somebody could make for $10 and 10 hours. They can have the best thoughts that a writer has ever had access to for years and years of thinking and working at it. That's an absolute, that might be one of the highest leverage activities a person can invest in.
Yeah, I love this. It feels very liberating to listen to you, Greg. In fact, very encouraging.
Good.
Because for wrong reasons, I also have a book ready in my mind. I have a script ready, but for maybe the wrong reasons, I never really dared writing it down and getting it out there. And maybe what you've just said gives me energy to go a step further. But building on what you've said, next question. How do you determine whether something you write is now good enough?
Yeah, look, there's let me answer this from Clayton Christensen, the late Harvard professor. He once told me, look, there's a kind of three-stool prong, you know, magic to ideas. You know, one is the writing, we just talked about that. One is the teaching, where you're out there sharing those ideas, and then the other is like the research, where you're actually sort of gathering new data. And he said, like, you have to be doing all three of them, and it's in the process of those three things that you learn, and your confidence. It's like at first, you have to take action with very low knowledge. That is writing something and being rubbish.
Yeah.
And then the same thing with teaching. You have to have a very low risk teaching environment. A small group who aren't paying anything, and you're just going to share those thoughts that you've been writing down. And as you're teaching it, you'll learn something, because that's what happens in good teaching. And you know, you'll get a new idea and say it in a new way, or someone else will get excited about a certain part of a story or a certain thing that surprises you. You didn't know. You're like, oh, well, that was one of 10 ideas, but that one resonated. And so it's in the teaching, and then you're publishing somewhere. So you're doing articles and you're publishing them. Now that could be micro articles, like micro blogging, you know, like literally on X or other services, where you're just putting out an idea and just seeing, does it resonate? And so that you have to get feedback from the marketplace of ideas. So there's just that's another part that takes courage. And that's the thing. It's like the courage to be rubbish in what you write, and it's the courage to publish. And it's in the process that you will learn. And so, you know, if you say to me, it might be what you were saying, is that, look, I have a book, I've written it end to end. I don't know if that is quite what you were saying, but let's imagine that. Well, in fact, let me take the pressure off you for a second. I have a manuscript of a book that I'm writing, and I have it end to end now. Mm-hmm. That's not the same at all as it being finished.
Mm-hmm.
That's an end to end version. Now I must take it into the world. I have to go and teach it and speak to people and publish pieces and see how to connect these ideas with their experiences right now. And there is discomfort in this process.
I can confirm that.
because there's something very sacred and vulnerable about taking something that has meaning for yourself and to put it out there. You know, it's this another biblical idea of like putting your pearls before swine. It's like, now, I'm not suggesting pearls before swine, but that sensation of this is meaningful, and then offering it, and somebody, yeah, I don't know, yeah, that doesn't do anything. And you're like, you know, this is so valuable and so precious. And if you would just understand this, yeah, it would change your life like it has mine. So it's an uncomfortable process, but it's in that process. Now, one should never let one person or even one group define the direction. It shouldn't be like that. But they have an important vote. You know, they have a vote, because they're the ones that are going to say, out of these hundreds, indeed millions of ideas, hundreds of thousands of books that will be published this year alone, every year, they're the ones that will help you. They will eventually decide which ones rise and which ones don't. In fact, there isn't anybody alive who really, in a precise scientific way, understands why the classic books are the classic books. Or why, out of those, let's say, 400,000 books that would be published in the US alone this year, why a tiny, tiny fraction of them will outsell everything else, all of the rest of them combined?
Yeah.
People don't know. And so when it's, you know, for a publisher, that's fine because they can say, well, here's, you know, here we'll publish lots and lots of books and we don't know which one will do better than we expect, but one of them will or two of them will, and we'll just play the, you know, play that game. But as an author, you can't play like that because you don't want, you know, you don't want it to be that only one out of 50 books that you write succeed. So you have to go through that process earlier, risk it small when it's not so painful, a little sting, but you try it and they will teach you and you keep going.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you, Greg. Two more crossroads between communication and leadership that I've just discovered while listening to you. The first one is about learning, like fail fast, learn fast, advance fast. But the other one, and maybe even more profound one, is when you described how you find out whether something you want to publish is starting to get really good, and that's resonance.
Yes.
Yeah, resonance from a reader, resonance from someone engaging with your thoughts.
Yes.
The similarity I see to leadership, which is my area where I spend my professional life, is impact, right? Some leaders think they are leading well when they do the way they think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
It's striking to see how many leaders believe that they are excellent leaders, and then crossing this with the many leaders who leave their leaders because they can't stand it anymore, right? So some things, there is a disconnect between self-perception and perception by others.
So right on.
So this concept of resonance that you apply in your writing and the concept of impact that I sometimes use as a measure for good leadership, I think they are very close friends and closely related. So this leads to my next question. In many ways, you lead. Greg, you've led the thinking of millions, probably dozens, if not hundreds of millions. If you think about leadership at its core, and I've, like you, I've been working on this topic for decades now. What to you is the essence of good leadership?
You know, the answer, the first answer that comes to mind is not my own definition, but I was just sharing it with my son, who was just, he's on a 2-year mission right now, and he was just assigned as a leader. And so it's an interesting moment to be able to try to understand where he's at, because he's, as an individual contributor, he's become increasingly competent. So he's doing that still, but he's now got to do it as a leader as well, an impact, you know, in a different way. And one of the definitions, Stephen Covey, before he died, he had a definition that he shared that I thought was, like, he didn't share it widely, but it became his more in like his final definition of leadership. I'll say it like that. And it was to see a person's potential more clearly than they can, and to express that to them. So that was the idea.
Yeah.
And it's not like nobody's ever thought about that before or expressed an idea like it, but it is quite a beautiful way of thinking about being a leader. In my son's case, it's an unusual assignment that he's been given, because in the hierarchy of the organization, a 200-person organization, he's just responsible for a small team, but that small team happens to be the leaders of the organization. So it's a little bit like being asked to be a coach to an executive team. You know, you're just responsible for a small team, but that team is responsible for a lot of people. So, and they're senior to him too. So it's like you're leading a group that's actually senior to you. So what does leadership look like? And it was a meaningful conversation to try and unravel that together, and to just remember how each of those people are people. You know, yes, the titles and the responsibilities, but they're just people, and they have their own vulnerabilities and their own sense of insecurity and uncertainty about the future, like all of us do. And so to be able to at least seek to have insight into their potential and to affirm that, and to just, you know, not tell someone immediately what they're getting wrong, but to see what they're getting right, and even the things that are their weaknesses, to try to imagine with them how those weaknesses, not that they could be eradicated, the weaknesses, but that those weaknesses could be grown into versions of their weakness that are strengths. That's a different thing than saying eradicate weakness and get strength. And it's a different thing to say take a weakness and make it a strength. It is to say the thing you think is a weakness might have a 2.0 version or a 3.0 version that is really valuable. And so to just that, to me, is part of what it means to see the potential in someone that they maybe don't see in themselves. That's a definition that I think, well, has been on my mind recently.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. That resonates a lot with me. Mm. It just reminds me of a person. I have had 16 different leaders during my corporate career. It resonates with one of them. And I would go through fire for him. He knows. And what you just described is one of the many things he has done to make me say this, because a couple of times he made me feel like, wow, he believes in my potential more than I do myself. So I think this is a very strong thought to define leadership, Greg. Thank you.
Can you tell me more about him for just a moment? Like what, you responded to my thoughts about leadership by saying, oh yes, that makes me think of him. But if I hadn't framed it like that, if it wasn't a response to a question and I was just asking you kind of out of the blue, of these 16 people that you had as managers, as leaders for you, who was the most positive impact? This would be the leader, I assume.
You're right. And okay. I think looking back, first of all, I was blessed, because in those 16, in three different companies, I was blessed in having many, many really good ones and a few outstanding ones. Mm. And the things that this gentleman did to make me say this now, and I've said it hundreds of times without him in the room, is first, he earned my trust.
How? Yeah, how?
By always being precise and crystal clear, Greg, whether what he was saying in the moment was an idea that may or may not be turned into a plan, a commitment, and an action, whether he was talking an idea or whether we were talking about a plan, a commitment, a decision. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He was crystal clear. And every single time I knew that he wasn't making the decision yet, he used words and body language to be clear about him being vague. It's an idea we are talking, right? Mm-hmm. But whenever he made a decision, this was a decision and this got executed without any exception. He never, ever surprised me. Mm-hmm. Never, right? And when you meet a person, and you're doing this with me right now, Greg, it's such an honor to have you on this show here. There are thousands of people typically listening. I hope this time it's even more. In every moment when you're engaging with a person, you can either be energy decretive or accretive to them. You can either take energy away from them or give them energy. And the second thing this man did with me over 3 years, every single time, in every single meeting, I left the conversation with more energy than I had going in. Yeah. And the last one, and that's what made me talk about him, is what you just said, which is expect and encourage. I think he believed in me more than I did. He expected me to raise the bar, to go to a high demanding goal. And then he encouraged me all the way just to the moment just before reaching the goal. And then maybe I had one day really enjoying that I kind of made it to that new level that I hadn't deemed possible before. But on the same day, he would come and raise the bar again. Right. So it was a game of expecting and encouraging and then expecting more.
So now this is a linguistic question and it might not be a fair one, but if you were to try to name that kind of leader, right? Like, what is that kind of leader? Like, what is a name that would capture, you know, if you were trying to bottle that type of, you know, when you think about what he did and what his impact was, what type of leader is that?
Strong and humble.
Okay. And then let me ask you this question. So what's the primary impact he had on you? Like, I mean, you can give more than one answer. That's fine. But I'm going to eventually narrow down to one. Like the thing that he, you know, when you look back, you go, oh, I grew. Was that the thing that was growth period? Or was it that it felt inspired? Or was it like, what was the primary impact he had on you?
He grew my confidence.
Yeah, that's interesting.
He grew my confidence. And again, with all due respect to this incredible man, he's not someone who comes in and takes the stage in the first 3 seconds, right? It's not about this loud or flashy first impression winning.
Yeah.
It's more about the second moment than the first moment. It's about doing what he says rather than saying something people want to hear. Mm-hmm. Right. So if I boil it down to two words, it's this, and this is very much also in line with Jim Collins' thinking. You may have read his book.
Yes, I have.
From Good to Great, when he describes what makes the difference.
Yeah.
And I was encouraged and I felt kind of confirmed, although it was new to me, that his first lesson was that at the time when those companies turn from good to great, that they are led by a level 5 leader who combines those two seemingly contradictory skills of having enormous willpower to get the right thing done, the right thing, not the popular thing, to get the right thing done and then make the right thing popular and have that coupled with something that seems contradictory. This sheer endless personal humility of always serving the greater good, serving the other person. Right? So willpower and humility. And the impact it has on me is it grows my confidence.
Mm. It's other language that he uses is like institutional ambition. So ambition for the institution while having personal humility, and that's part of the dichotomy. Now, as you say, he calls it a level 5 leader. And in one sense, nothing wrong with that because he's contrasting it to 4 other types of leader, and particularly level 4 leader would be the kind of leader people would think was at the top of the pyramid. That is a visionary with 1,000 helpers. You know, I've got the vision and I'll tell you all what to do and then you can help me do it. Whereas in the level 5 leaders were distinct and different. The only thing that's unsatisfying to me about the language of level 5 leader is that it doesn't name in that title the dichotomy. Now, I'm a linguist at heart about these things, obsessive about names and naming things and trying to come up with terms to say the very thing, to pinpoint the new meaning. But if you say, well, this leader was a level 5 leader and had this contrasting dynamic, to actually name give a one word, like making up a word or selecting, I think you probably have to make up a word that captures that dichotomy, that duality, so that then it's easier to express the idea of a level 5 leader without just saying level 5 leader who's the four kinds, and then they've got these two different kinds of elements. It's like if the name was right, you could communicate that much more quickly. It's an interesting challenge for the future.
Oh, yes. Thank you. And I just thought, okay, that must have been one similar avenue of thinking that brought you to essentialism.
Oh, absolutely.
I love your book. I just love it. I'm running leadership courses with 4-digit numbers of people a year, thousands of people a year. And many times I ask my wife, Tanya, order another 20, please, because we are giving your book as a tool to open minds and to wrestle with many of the leadership challenges that are defining leaders' lives today. So thank you, Greg, for sharing your books.
Thank you for taking those ideas and to multiply, you're being a trim tab, you're being that small rudder that moves the large rudder that moves the ship, and both for the essentialism ideas, but of course more broadly for these leadership ideas. And I think it's worth just double clicking on this, because what you said was, okay, we give copies of essentialism because to open people's minds. And of course, a book worth its salt is trying to do that, right? It's trying to say, hey, you thought about it this way, but really this is a way to think about it that's going to be much more helpful to you. It's a mindset shift. And selecting, and if necessary, as I felt it was with essentialism, inventing terms, right? To be an essentialist, to be an essentialist leader, an essentialist. That as soon as you have that term, it was hard one term, but once you have it, you go, okay, this is about embodying a principle. It's more than just, okay, on the outskirts, you need to figure out what's essential and eliminate what's non-essential so you can get the most important things done. Yes, it is that, but it's more than that. It's something you become. You become more and more of who you really are, less and less of who you really aren't. You push out the non-essentials in your life so they don't define you. And having the language, it's an argument in favor of naming phenomena and naming leadership phenomena so that it can become a gateway to faster mindset shifting. And it's an interesting challenge. I mean, that's its own point. But as an aside to that point, I wrestle with that with this new book, I'm trying to decide whether I think it's a calling or a curse. It's like it's both of those things. To be trying to name a very particular type of person or leader who I think is exactly relevant for the precise challenge that we have right now. That is its own special job to be done. But I'm getting close with it now.
Absolutely, please keep going. And I love the way you challenge me, because so far I can say it in 3 words.
Yeah.
I can say it in 2 words, but I can't say it yet in 1 word in a precise manner. In 3 words, it's leading with impact.
Yeah.
In 2 words, it's willpower and humility.
Yeah.
And if I try to say it in 1 word, if I say it in 1 word, I'm missing, though.
I know.
I'm missing the dichotomy. It's unleash. unleashing. But it's then I'm missing the dichotomy. So yes. Essentialism nails it so well. It's amazing.
Well, but this is the job to be done. And this is why you don't have to let's just riff one more second on writing. The gift of writing is that you are storing value for the future. Writing and money have that in common. The primary reason you need money is not as a means of exchange. Yes, that is helpful. But it's the primary value of money is that it is, and this is a friend of mine, Andre, a professor at Cambridge, that has taught me this. But the primary value of money is a medium of exchange in the future. It's that you allows you to do something later. And that's a great invention. You can store the value for a future you want to create. And in a similar way, writing is the same. You are creating value and insight for the future. And so when you write, okay, first it's three words, then it's two words, and you're writing that down. And then you're writing, well, why is that a struggle? I can't seem to get these two words to go together. Why can't I? Because we think of these ideas as two opposite ideas. Okay, so that means, you know, in our language, we have thought about them as being separate. But self-evidently, they are not separate, right? Like self-evidently, they are not always separate because you are describing a leader who embodies both. So even though our language thinks of them as not just different, but really different, you're saying there are such people that embody both, and it allows them to do, to be far more effective than they would be if they were only one or the other. So it means we can come up with a term, either find one that already exists or come up with a term that names that combination.
Yeah.
And it will be a great value to what you're doing to be able to identify that. You don't need the term yet. You can keep on writing, but you can keep playing with the term many, many times, give your best thinking to your future self and come back to it then and create it then.
Greg, thank you. That's one of the many things that I will personally take away from this conversation is I will keep on working on this, I promise, okay?
Do it.
Let's shift to another area that is related to essentialism, that's related to leadership as well. That is the use of resources. And maybe when I go back to the beginning, more than three decades ago, when I started working in the corporate world, I was in my first budget meeting. We talked about options, strategies, plans, investments, but all the only kind of investment we talked about, late 80s, was money. I don't remember us talking about time at all in these old days. Mm. Nowadays, my perception, Greg, is, I'd be interested in yours, is that the balance between money and time in terms of being the scarcest resource, and I'm not naive, money still matters, right? We need money to fund the lives we want to live. I'm not naive. But my perception is that the balance is tilting towards time becoming the scarcer resource. And first, I'd be interested in, do you see it differently or similarly? And then building on this is, one thing where we will likely agree is that time is a scarce resource. It's the only non-renewable one in life. How do you manage your own time?
So there was a lot to unpack there, and then a kind of very tangible question at the end. Look, one way to answer that is with reference to the Essentialism Planner, because when I first wrote Essentialism, a sister company to my publisher had approached me about writing a kind of journal, you know, to come out right after Essentialism within the first year or two. And so I signed a contract to do that and then started to try to create the tool. And the more I worked on it, the more I thought, I just don't think I have anything useful or anything that's satisfying to me to be materially better than what else is out there. And so I don't want to create another product for the sake of it. And that's how that went for years. Now, I write a journal, I have my own paper and pen process that I follow. every day, literally hardly missed a day, maybe not missed a day in 14 years now. And so in the process of iterating that, finally, a couple of years ago, I thought, you know, actually, I think I have something now. I think it's very simple. It's very simply, you know, clear. And I think this could be useful to, you know, in fact, I know it's useful to people because, you know, they're using it and they've talked about it. So that's when I created this. And so the tool really has two main parts. One is a personal quarterly offsite, where you're thinking about the big ideas. You know, I just did the last time I did mine, I did it with my wife, Anna. So we both did it individually. I mean, we literally used the planner that's now available to everyone, the exact process, which has three big questions. What is essential that I'm underinvesting in? What's non-essential that I'm overinvesting in? And how can I make it as effortless to accomplish those things that matter most? Those are the three questions. And it's, you're asking them, you know, we took several hours over the course of a weekend, really, just to take time, quite luxurious time, I would say, just ourselves to think and then to talk and then to share our lists and to discuss again. And, you know, that space to create time to think about those bigger questions and to adjust means that you lower the probability that you will be significantly off course in your life. We're always off course, but how quickly do you align? And if even once a quarter, a person can create space to get clear about those questions, to discuss it with somebody else, to make decisions together around it, then you are, you know, no more than 90 days from, you know, from being able to organize yourself to come back on track. Now, the daily process, I think, is really simple. And my life experience changes when I do it versus when I don't. And it's got a very simple structure, three questions: what, so what, now what. So every day you begin with what's going on, and it's just a download of all of the noise. And then number two, so what? Why does it matter? What does this mean? All of this noise, what does it mean? Does it mean I need to get more organized? Does it mean I need to say no to things? Does it mean I need to hire more help? Does it mean that I need to create space to execute? What does it mean? What's the news today? And then the now what has a very specific structure, and that is the 1-2-3 method. So you're identifying every day what's the number one priority, singular, the priority project for the day. What are two things that are essential but also urgent, so they're pressing upon us? And then three is three maintenance items. That is the laundry of our life. It doesn't really press upon us normally. It just sort of has to be done. But if you don't do it, it makes the future a lot harder. So the maintenance items are to make execution more easy in to your future self. That structure, that process, is a process I have found to be so useful that I finally got over my hesitancy I literally canceled the contract because I just not ready to do it, and finally went the other direction and said, okay, I'm going to initiate this and make this happen. So that is a tool. I don't follow it perfectly. I don't do it every day, but the difference is noticeable and clear for when I'm more intentional in how I organize that.
Yeah, cool. Very clear, very structured, very simple also, because it's only three different questions, a small enough number to memorize. Mm. Now, you just alluded to it already, because you said some days you do it, maybe others not that rigidly. When you think about your last couple of months, do you detect a pattern whether and when you yourself find it hard to adopt an essentialism mindset?
Yeah, you know, I think that the best answer to that question is to just share what I think has changed in the last decade. So if you go back, you know, a decade or so, of course we're in the information age. Fully in the information age, and the primary externality of the information age, like the thing you don't want but you get, is distraction. And clearly, we still have distraction. But as we've entered completely the influencer slash AI age, the primary externality isn't distraction, it's disorientation. And that's a big shift. That's a sea change type of experience change. And I ask audiences this now all the time, who feels today just buried in noise? And everybody agrees. Now, that's interesting, that word noise, because it comes from the Latin word nausea. So that idea, when we say noise, it's not just... we're describing seasickness. So the sea change that we have encountered leaves us feeling literally kind of seasick, nauseous. What is happening? Where am I? Am I upside down? What's happened in the last 10 minutes, the last day? What's the new trend? It's moving so fast. It's so hard to get a sense of where we are. And so whatever response, if you have a stimulus, if you say distraction is the problem, and then you have a response to it, maybe you say essentialism is the response to it, let's say, and you go, okay, well, that's equal to it, and so now we can have success again. The challenge is significant, but we have a response that's robust enough. But then if it shifts from distraction to disorientation, it's like, no, that's different, because distraction, almost by definition, is like, you know what matters, you know what's essential, but you're being pulled off course by something else that's either just easier in the moment or more glamorous or more, closer in your pocket, or it's acting upon you, but you're being pulled off course. Disorientation is you don't really know what the course even is. You don't know where you are, it's a much more fragmented state. And so what's the new response? What do we need now? Now, we've got just a little more to unpack there, because why are we disoriented? I mean, you can say it's the state of change, just the pace of change. And I think AI speaks to that, because, we all remember, it's been a couple of years now, but we remember that moment when we first used GPT and we're just like, oh my goodness, the world is now different. Literally, this is it. The world will never go back. It's one of those absolute literal, sort of not literal, but sea change moments. So that's symbolic of something. But it's more even than that, because when people feel disoriented, they want to escape. They escape to what social media has become. And what social media has become is this extremely polarized place. And so you try to escape disorientation into the noisiest possible environment. And so it, of course, is accelerating the same phenomenon. Now, one more, if you don't mind. I know I'm being conceptual and building on these concepts, but...
Please go on.
There is a human weakness that I think is, let's just call it universal human weakness.
Okay.
And it's this. It's that if I say something, okay, I've just said a bunch of things, right? And you're listening and other people are listening. And the risk is, and the weakness is, we listen to agree or disagree. Well, do I agree with what he's saying? Do I disagree with what he's saying? It's evaluative. And we've known for at least, let's say, like maybe 70 years, we've known from the time of Carl Rogers, from his research, he was the most important psychotherapist of the 20th century. At the time, became a real household name, particularly in the US. But now is very, very, you know, people hardly know him, you know, outside of the therapeutic processes. So this is just not somebody people talk about or is quoted a lot. But he utterly transformed the whole of psychotherapy, because prior to him, it's Freud and all of this. Now, he clearly observed and identified this human weakness. You know, people want to say something. As soon as they say something, somebody is already evaluating. And that human weakness has been literally capitalized on over the last 10 years. So this polarization, this disorientation, this reactivity isn't a bug, it's the feature. It's not an irritant, it's the business model. This weakness that's, as I say, let's say it's always been with us, has been turned into the most valuable companies in the world. So, of course, if there is a business model that's externality is disorientation, fragmentation, polarization, and we don't really see that that's the system and that we're still a part of it, we are still a node in that model, we'll just keep on absorbing it, breathing it in, drinking it in, and so on. And so it's kind of like this perfect storm. There are people becoming extremely wealthy from it, but we are being used. And so, you know, to me, you know, that's lots of kind of, you know, it's analysis of where I think we are. You know, as I look back over the last couple of months, to come back to your specific question, you know, much kind of, you know, smaller personal question to me, that's what I find. I find not in the sense of spending too much time on social media and so on, but where I have felt disoriented, which I have at times because of quite major challenges, not of my making, but, you know, outside of my control. But I have a very good friend, for example, my best friend of many, many years, 35 years, who's dying.
Sorry to hear that.
Thank you. And many other things of that type. Well, that's disorienting, especially if you have multiple things happening at once. So in those kinds of moments, you say, okay, well, prioritizing today is actually still a good intent and outcome, but you sort of have to come to a step before it. You have to say, oh my goodness, you know, like, just what is happening? What's going on? And to try to get that perspective, to find meaning in the disorientation, to connect the dots again, because the nature of disorientation is that you're going to be made into a thing you didn't ever want to be, which is a reactor. You've become something, and it has been intended for you, because reactors make a lot of money for people. You know, that's the you click on the bait and you send the link, and you get emotionally engaged, and you're fighting with somebody online, or you're reading with online, and then you're fighting with somebody in your own life, or you listen with a very reactive way to what people are going to say. Will they say the right thing? Will they say the right thing about Elon Musk, or the wrong thing about Elon Musk? Will they say the right thing about, and we could go on, you know, all of those touch points, you know, that are so sensitive to people, and people assuming massive things about them. This type of becoming a reactor, for whatever the reason is, all the kind of perfect storm, is sort of the least effective, least empowered way to show up in an environment that is so capable of disorienting us.
We
become a prisoner to the system instead of becoming a creator of it, and so on.
A follow-on question on this, Greg. You already gave part of the answer, but I'd like to dwell on it a little more. One of the key essences I take away from the last minute or two is the distinguishing between distracting and disorienting. And I also, your thought of this kind of evaluative listening, always trying to judge, is he right or is he wrong? And this resonates with me. My hypothesis is this has become even harder in the last 10 years because there were not only a pandemic, there is new ways of working. There is tech that is changing a lot of things, including large language models that you alluded to. The question that Barry, thank you, Barry, shared, and I would like to share with you is, has your approach to essentialism and how you use it changed in those 10 years, or is it still basically the same?
Well, let's say it in two ways. I think that essentialism is more relevant now than it was before. Every year, more people hear about essentialism than they knew the year before. The momentum is building and the work is not yet done, right? Like, that's the first thing. And so if a person goes from not having read it or tried to apply essentialism in their lives, you know, like you described your own introduction to it, the introduction will still be relevant and helpful. What I think, and this, the multi-year journey I've been on to leave to go to Cambridge with our family and do a doctorate and to write this new book is as concrete evidence of my belief that there is a new challenge that requires a new response than anything else I could illustrate. It's like, well, I could just have carried on doing what I was doing. The demand has not changed. The demand has increased. There is, you know, endless requests and invitations. You know, we're very grateful for that. But I felt that the challenge was so significant, it was deserved a sort of time out. Let me try to understand. Let me see the big picture. Let me see what we might need to do now. Let me see and to name the kind of person and leader who has this power of relevancy right now in the world. And so yes, I think the answer is that my thinking has evolved. And so I still think essentialism is highly relevant for distraction. I still want to live my own life based upon what is essential. It's just that in order to do that in this environment, I need to be able to think at a higher level, operate at a better level. It's a little like the quote ascribed to it's ascribed to Einstein, you know, that the problems we have will not be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created the problems. Now, he didn't say those words, but he did write a letter to the United Nations with the spirit of those words. And actually, the actual words he used, maybe I'll just actually look them up, because I really think that they are beautiful in their own right. Let me see if I can find them. What Einstein actually said was in 1946, an open letter in the United Nations, in which he wrote, "A new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive and move toward higher levels." I quite literally believe that that is true again. And so, in a kind of meta answer to your question, what essentialism looks like to each person changes as they change, because what a person perceives as essential will change, one, because their circumstances will change, but also because they change. And so as a person matures or understands new realities, or a combination of both of those things, what is essential, evolves. And so I love that he, in fact, uses the word essential in the actual written statement. A new type of thinking is essential if mankind is to survive and move toward higher levels. That's just how I think about the world right now. And the new work that I'm doing is what do we need to move to handle an environment where of disorientation, where people are struggling to understand each other, to even wanting to talk to each other. So that's a different kind of problem. That's not, hey, we're talking and I can't understand you. Yeah. It's I fear being misunderstood so much. I fear losing something in the encounter so much. I fear what you're saying and the impact it will have on the world so much, we can't even talk.
Yeah, I agree.
This we have to do something about, and I would like to try.
And please keep trying, and let me make two more connections.
Please.
The first one is about talking. What you just said made me think, gosh, one of the reasons why I'm getting nervous in the last 2-3 months is that people start to talk less with each other and more about each other.
For sure.
Which is one of the things that losing teams do.
Right.
One of the things I can distill it down to, I've been lucky to be in high performing teams 4 times. I've been on teams and I've been in groups who weren't a team at all. One of the most simple distinguishing factors between losing and winning teams is in losing teams, people talk about each other. In winning teams, people talk with each other, right? So that's one of the things. And back to you, keep
going. I want to riff on that just for a second, and then I want to hear the more of what you were going to
yes,
go to.
Yes.
So I think there's a middle option, which is, sort of talking over email. And so that's mm-hmm. not the same as talking about each other, which is kind of the real meeting that happens after the meeting has passed.
Yes.
Right? There's that kind of a problem. And then there's, the ideal that you're describing, which is not just talking with each other, but I would add one more piece, which is talking with each other about the real issues.
Yeah.
Because there's so many meetings now. I mean, we have a meeting inflation that's taken place, both in terms of the number of meetings that people have has increased and the number of people in those meetings has increased. And probably as a very natural consequence of that, the amount of the degree to which people are paying attention in those meetings has decreased. So if people have to try and fit in getting something done at some point, they just do it inside of the meetings and aren't really paying any attention.
Yeah.
And so you have this situation where, yeah, you're together, but you're not talking about the real issues. In fact, I was just on LinkedIn and put this post out there and they, okay, what's the biggest challenge with meetings? And one of the options was not talking about the real issue. And 50% of the 2,000 people that responded were saying that that's the top issue. That was the number one issue. So, yes, so you meet, but you don't talk about the real issues.
Yeah.
And then I think that sort of, as I say, middle option is like talk, you talk, but it's over email. So, of course, you don't get to the real issues because it's not safe enough to get to the real issues there. And so too much context is lost and so on. But with those additional, just the nuances, please continue.
Yeah. I would like to make another reference to another field of life that probably every member of our audience today is aware of. I just had the honor of working with him for a couple of months in launching the very first iPhone into the world outside the United States. I wasn't close. It wasn't a daily exercise, but it was over a couple of months very intense to decide what pricing strategy to use to launch iPhone number one outside the US. Mm. And I once had the pleasure to spend a day with Steve Jobs live in a room in Berlin in 2007, just before this groundbreaking innovation was launched. Don't know whether you ever had the chance to work with Steve or to see him, to exchange with him, but here is the connection. I have never met anyone in my life who had two often opposite strengths united in one person. So when I was a young guy, I was a marketing director, marketing leader. I spent time in advertising. Oftentimes I was working with great agencies who had two kinds of people. On the one hand side, the creatives that were visionary, that were breakthrough thinkers and created news every single minute. Typically, these people were less structured, less focused. And on the other side, you have those strategic planners in agencies who are very focused and very structured, but typically not quite as visionary or creative. Steve Jobs, the one I perceived by seeing films, reading books, and in that one day I had a live meeting with him, was the person who had both of those skills on an exceptionally high level, being visionary and being structured and focused. When I think about what he has done to us and done with us, it is very close to essentialism. He was enormously able to focus on the few things that matter the most, which could be your language, Greg. So my question is, have you ever had the chance? Or if not, what would Steve Jobs have said about essentialism?
Yeah, so Steve came and did his commencement at Stanford right before I was a student there. And so it was a very particular kind of time in his journey. He was back at Apple by that point, but only really just. So the resurgence and renaissance of Apple had begun, but it was still early enough that they were a $30 billion company at that time. So they had three $10 billion companies, and one of the reasons I remember that so clearly is that the financial executive team at Apple, so led by Tim Cook, had an evening where they invited Stanford Business School students to attend because they wanted to try and hire people into Apple. And why that stands out to me is because for about an hour, I was the only person that turned up. And it was it was really awkward. It was awkward because they were all there, I just felt embarrassed. I didn't want to be the representative of the business school and to feel that they would be feeling they were wasting their time. But a few others did turn up eventually. But they gave their whole presentation and their vision, and that's not a startup, right? A $30 billion company is, of course, not a startup, but it's still nowhere close to the footprint of the organization, today.
Yeah.
This is also still, that was still pre-iPhone. So I've gone on to work with Apple University and with executives at Apple, for over many years. There's a lot that one could try to unpack from it. But I think the thing I want to unpack the most is that Steve evolved. And that really matters to me because in answer to your question, was he an essentialist? And the answer is, from my point of view, very clearly yes. But it's a nice example of what we were talking about before, as somebody matures, somebody grows, what's essential to them is different, and how they operate is different, and how they lead is different. And it's a good example of where the media chooses a narrative from some previous incarnation of a person and just keeps on looking at them through that narrative, through that lens, even when it doesn't really fit anymore. So in the early days, he's very focused and also clearly capable of being extremely belligerent towards people and really in pure impatience to do something great and to build something amazing, is willing to sacrifice almost any, just anyone around him because of that vision, because of his commitment to that. Well, after he gets fired from Apple, he goes, you know, well, let's just in a moment get to that. But after he returns to Apple and to close towards the end of his death, Isaacson writes a biography that becomes, you know, becomes the canon of Jobs' life, in the sense that that's the, if people have read one book about Steve Jobs, that's the one they'll have read. And I'm not saying it's a badly written book at all. However, the people that know him best don't love it. And the reason they don't love it is because they felt that it was not nuanced in the growth story of Steve and how different he became. And that's just an error that's so easy for media to make, and it made for easy headlines and more, you know, the clickbait that we've been talking towards in some ways. A book that captures it much better, and that the people closest to Steve actually participated directly in, is a book called Becoming Steve Jobs, which covers the 10 years he's gone. Actually, most people don't even remember that he was gone for a whole decade, right? You know, like you don't remember the absence of somebody all the time. And so, yes, okay, he's doing all this stuff at Apple, and then other headlines, and then, oh, he's back at Apple. You're just like, you don't notice. A decade goes by. What does he do for a decade? He's over at Pixar, where he learns by participating what it looks like to have high quality, amazing debate-driven decisions, really dealing with the issues under the table, really getting clear, pinpointing what matters, unlocking the things that are keeping people stuck, figuring out how to go forward in the simplest, best possible way, executing together as a team. By the second change is he gets married and has a family. Those are non-trivial changes. That is an enormous upgrade in his ability to become interpersonally effective in leading teams. When he gets back to Apple, he's he's become an essentialist leader by that point. Not just an essentialist kind of essentialist with like, you know, clear weaknesses and blind spots. He's become an essentialist with a far richer view of the world. And you know, the team of people he built around him was an utterly world class team. Any one of them could have gone off and been a CEO, as of course we know a couple did go on to be CEOs. Any one of them could have gone at any moment. So they stay because they want to stay. They say, and this is their defensiveness, but it's a good defensiveness, is you don't do the best work of your life, of your career, for someone who's just some kind of jerk. That's not what happens. That's not that isn't the formula that works. So when you think that somebody's just a jerk over there, you're not participating in Sonder if they're producing extraordinary things over a long period of time.
I agree.
And so yes, I think that he became an evolved, extremely evolved essentialist. I felt like we lost a lot, and you know, like in a strange kind of personal way. I felt like I lost a lot when he died, and I was there in Palo Alto, and we're, you know, outside of the Apple store there, one of the, perhaps I think the original Apple store. But you know, there's everyone had just put post-it notes on, just people of the, just describing what they loved so much. It's so thoughtful. He's so interesting. And clearly, the dichotomy that we've been kind of playing with all through this conversation was embedded in that evolved version of Steve.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing this. A few more avenues to explore. One of the ones that probably resonate a lot with many people in the audience right now has to do with two phenomena. One, let me share that of mine. It's probably my biggest enemy in doing my own work. When I was a young guy starting to do my work, I thought an essence of bad leadership is micromanagement, handcuffing people. And today I think this isn't wrong at all. This is true, but it's way too small a thinking. There is a much bigger thought around it, inside it, beyond it, which is egocentricity, right? I think the best way I can articulate poor leadership today is that it's egocentricity in all its forms, like narcissism and all the others. But there is another element, which is leading upwards, right? In the old-fashioned way of thinking about leadership from the last millennium, when my father was still around working in the steel factory, Greg, leadership was mainly telling people what to do downwards, if you think in a hierarchical way. My view on leadership is 360 degrees. The most important person I am leading is myself. It took me years to realize this. The second most important person I am leading is my boss. So the woman or the man who is responsible for the whole show. and this is where more and more questions are coming my way in the last couple of months, Greg. So this leads me to my next question to you. Leading upwards with essentialism. Many leaders struggle with bosses who micromanage them, who lack focus, who are non-essentialists.
Right.
So do you have any advice for those people who struggle? How can an essentialist mindset help someone effectively lead upwards without causing friction?
Yeah, look, first of all, definite problem, serious challenge, hear it all the time. I'd be an essentialist. I would love to be an essentialist, but my boss and boss's boss and boss's boss's boss, you know, they're not, they ask for everything. What can I do? I'm down here. You know, I can't just say no to everybody, you know, without thinking about it, just, you know, blunt and out there. That's just career limiting. And I'm always like, yep, I wouldn't start with that either. You know, don't think I wrote that you should, you know, like to say no to everyone and everything without really thinking about it would be noism, you know, and that's a different book. I wrote Essentialism. So the question would be, might be posed like this. It's how can you figure out what is most essential for your boss and for not just directly their opinion, but like what are they dealing with? What's their reality? And so that you can shift from being an order taker to a trusted advisor. So we've just riffed on Steve Jobs. Sometimes, despite the fact I just spent a reasonable amount of time on that, sometimes I think it's overdone, or at least there was a period of time that, you know, he's just quoted everything. Oh, yes, Steve Jobs. And he's this is how you have to lead. And it felt a little overdone. And then in my research, I came across a story of someone who said no to Steve and lived to tell the tale, and got paid $100,000 to do it. And I think this is illustrative of how an essentialist might influence up. So it was after Steve has been fired from Apple and he's got his $100 million as his payment. And with that, he's going to start his next company. And he starts, the next company is Next. One of the things he's lost is, yeah, one of the best brand, like icon logos, that's what I'm looking for, logo, that's ever been made. Because it's a logo that the thing is the name without using any typography. So that's rare. If you look around at logos, you find that most of the time, you know, you're not able to do that. So he's lost something, and he wants to get a great logo. It's probably disproportionately important to him. So he goes out and he gets the top logoist in the world, who'd created ABC's logo, Bloomingdale's, and so many other household named logos. Paul Rand is his name. And he has a meeting with Rand, and in sort of this is early on in Next Days, so it's early into that 10 years. So it's a less evolved version of Steve, but you know, still an interesting time, an interesting person. Well, he meets with Rand and he says, look, this is how it's going to be. I want this great logo. I want you to bring me like 10 different ideas, and I'm going to tell you which ones I hate, which ones I love, and so on, right? Like he starts describing how the engagement is going to work. And so there's a hierarchical relationship that's been established, okay? It's already established by the fact that he's getting paid by him. He doesn't want to lose this contract. It's a great opportunity. It's a lot of money. And so what would you do? And what he said, he did say no. He said, look, no. He said, I am going to solve your problem for you. And then you're going to pay me. That's how it's going to be. Now, maybe there's a little more to those words, but that's the way that Steve tells the story. He said that Paul Rand brought him a jewel of a logo, one, and it was the complete solution. He said it was an absolute jewel. And then he adds this, which I think is important. He said Paul Rand was the ultimate professional because he'd thought through what was important, essential, valuable to me more deeply than I had.
Wow.
And that's the insight. That's how you apply essentialism up. Even applying essentialism just in your own life isn't the same as an egotistical essentialism. It doesn't have to be. It could if that's the maturity somebody's at. But essentialism, even to apply to self, is what really matters. You're trying to understand what really is the answer, you know, the truth about what really is important in the world, not just what you happen to be thinking right now.
Yeah.
And that's what that proactive approach of really understanding Steve's actual dilemma, his actual challenges, the message he's really trying to communicate, the vision of the logo, and solving the actual deep need is what was just enormously valuable. Yeah. And that's an example of essentialism managing up.
Awesome. A great example. Thank you so much for sharing it, Greg. Really an inspiring, mind-opening way to think about it. So I love it. Thank you. A few more before
give me two more.
Two more. There is one, which is essentialism ever wrong?
The easy answer to that question is there are ways to apply essentialism that are clearly wrong, which isn't quite what your question is. So it's not entirely avoiding it, but not entirely answering it. So is essentialism ever wrong? You bet. If somebody oversimplifies the message, if they take it as noism, for example, and they sort of thoughtlessly cut everything out, or if they say, well, this thing is important to me, and therefore I will say no to anything and everything and everyone that isn't this, that also is going beyond what is actually even written, never mind going beyond the spirit of what is written in essentialism. So there's many ways in which one could misapply essentialism. And if you're misapplying it, then yes, those could all be wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Being too strained in one's sense of focus. And now this is written explicitly in essentialism, this concern and a solution to it. But if people sort of take just the jargon of essentialism, turn it into jargon, that means they don't understand what it really means. They're just bandying the idea about. Then think of focus as a noun, that is a thing you have, the focus. This is the goal. But focus is also a verb, to focus, to keep focusing. And essentialism combines both. You must try to figure out what is essential so you know what you're pursuing, but it's also, and it's embedded in both title and subtitle so as not to be misunderstood, it is an ism, an ongoing aspiration, living, way of thinking. And then in the subtitle, a disciplined pursuit. It's not finished. That's it. We've figured out the essential thing. Imagine if our eyes woke up this morning, we woke up and our eyes took a single picture, and that was the last time they focused the whole day. Think of how we would see nothing in focus. Nothing would work. And so this, again, would be a counterfeit for essentialism. So there's many counterfeits for essentialism that could maybe use the language. If you are constantly ongoing, pursuing what is essential, what matters now, and let me put aside the things that are of less value, either by eliminating them completely or letting them fall out of your life, or just investing in them a little less to the appropriate amount, and then you're trying to build systems to make it as effortless to complete those important work and invest in those important relationships. That ongoing process, I think, is pretty hard to argue with. I don't think that there are many circumstances in which that process isn't right. So yeah. It's about, you know, and that is essentialism in its name, subtitle, and structure is about the process. It's not a content-focused book or set of ideas. You know, I don't say at any point in the book, this is what should be essential to you, or this is what is essential, you know, even what is essential to me, although I kind of hint at that. That's not the point. The point is, do you have a process, intentional, deliberate process for exploring, creating space to explore what's essential, eliminate what's not, and make it as effortless as possible to actually do those things on an ongoing basis? And I think that I don't know if it's always right. That seems too much. But I can't think of really many circumstances. Maybe I can't think of any in which the process that is essentialism is not the right process.
Awesome. I think this is a wonderful way to wrap up this conversation and to come towards an end. Greg, I can't express enough how grateful I feel for you investing this time. Thank you so much. It's been an honor. It's been a pleasure. And I would like to give you the last word. I will listen to this conversation a couple of times. You've given me tons of value to think about. I'm sure that our audience will feel the same. So, challenge to the audience or question to the audience. If you could give our audience today one essentialist challenge or one essentialist question to leave them with, what would it be, Greg?
There's a little story that just immediately comes to mind, and it's not my story, but somebody sent it to me, and I was so touched by it, I invited the person who wrote it onto the podcast, and his name is Eric Newton, and he wrote up a story, his story, about how his wife was dying of cancer. And he said, you know, we had a good relationship, in some ways an epic relationship, ups and downs, like, you know, in a sense all relationships have. He said, but, you know, as we're doing more caring and working together, you know, in one sense it gets better and closer. He said, but then 6 weeks before she died, something shifted, and she became more focused than she'd ever been, but on a very particular thing. So her regret, what became clear to her as a regret as she entered that something like the in-between, right, where she knows, like, this is, you know, the end is coming now, like, it's, you know, we're here. Her regret was not having been as intimate and deeply connected with the people who mattered most to her in her life. So it wasn't that she had bad relationships, but it was different. It was like there's whole layers of meaning that I've withheld because I'm either busy or because, of course, it's vulnerable. And so he articulates what it was like to spend time with someone who is removing layer after layer until there are no layers of hiding. And he said, I discovered a type of love I didn't think was possible. I didn't know it existed in the human experience. And it was, you know, he offers so many gems in his writing. And then, you know, I think in the conversation we had too, we covered some of them. But he said, look, if there's a point to it all, it is to develop ever deepening relationship with the people who matter most. He said, like, if there's a point, that's it. Like he says, at the end, that's what you're going to care about. And that is it's a very touching story in my mind. You know, it's a hard won set of lessons, even though I'm only capturing just a hint of some of his expressions and his ways of articulating that experience. I would encourage people to listen to the episode and to read it, what he wrote in that raw processing right after she passed. But I think that's as good an invitation as I can make is who matters most to you? What matters most to them? What's the one tiniest thing you can do for them that will make the largest deposit for the smallest investment, and start there. That, wow, to me, is kind of a nexus point of both essentialism and everything I've been working on since then that we've been touching a little upon today.
Brilliant. I just have goosebumps all over my body from forehead to shin. What a brilliant way to end this conversation. Greg, I'm grateful. Thank you for your time. It's been inspiring on so many different levels. I knew why I was looking forward for a couple of months to have you on my show. Now I know even more. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much. All the very best. Please keep on unfolding essentialism and effortless in the next book you're writing. I'll be one of your first readers. I'll continue to be one of your strongest salesmen. It's been a pleasure and an honor, and I look forward to our paths crossing again. Thank you very much. Dear Greg McKeon.
Thank you so much.